All right. I'm in the overview page there for those of you. I'll be following what you're looking at. And after we get past the overview, it'll all be in outline format. So, but Daniel was a 16-year-old son of nobility when he was carried off to Babylon by Ashpenaz, Nebuchadnezzar's chief of eunuchs. The implications of that are strong. He had grown up in the last 14 years of King Josiah's 31-year reign. King Josiah was the last great godly king of Judah. And he came along at the very end of Judah's existence, before they were hauled off into captivity in Babylon. Going back to King David, in about a year 1000 B.C., God had established Israel as a major power. They were kind of the world beater at that particular point in time. And of course, the world wasn't very big. And the known world, who knows what was going on in China. But as far as the known world around the Mediterranean basis, they were there. David reigned long and well for a lot of years, and then he turned it over to Solomon. And Solomon had a magnificent reign. Solomon was the wealthiest man in the world. It's reputed to be the wisest man in the world. Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines, so he must not have been that wise. But they led him into pagan worship. All these wives led him away from God. And so Solomon, who started off very, very well, crashed and burned at the end of his reign. And then at the very end of his reign, he regrets it. And he writes a book called Ecclesiastes, in which he talks about how foolish all of his riches and wealth were, because they only set him up for failure. After Solomon, and somewhat because of the excesses of Solomon, his kingdom gets split into two pieces. In the north are the 10 tribes known as Israel, the nation of Israel, with a capital city based in Samaria. And they're basically led by a man who was at one time the chief of all laborers for Solomon. His name was Jeroboam. Solomon was a tax and spend guy. He was a Republican, but he was a tax and spend Republican. And God had warned the people that if they took on a king, that he would tax them out of their minds, and he would take their children for his purposes. And he did. They coerced every alien person who came into the land, and they drafted your kids to go to work in their various pieces of the empire, and taxed them very, very, very heavily. When Solomon dies, his son Rehoboam is ascends to the throne, and his father's advisors tell him that the empire is about ready to crack, and what you need to do is to reduce the taxes and let people have more of their own money and take this burden off of them and quit doing all these excessive things that you're doing. For instance, Solomon had 12-14 chariot cities, nothing but chariots, and the manufacture and the management of his chariots. It was interesting because God had forbidden Israel to have chariots. And this went on and on and on and on and on. So Rehoboam was advised by Solomon's counselors, the men who had been all around Solomon, that he needed to change the whole approach, loosen up on the financial burden on the people, and quit taking on all these things that God had forbidden that were causing everybody to work night and day for the king's benefit. Rehoboam had some counselors his own age, as most young princes would growing up. And they had not had their chance at the trough yet. And so they encouraged Rehoboam that he should tell the people, and the way the Bible puts it is a little graphic, but we're adults. He said, tell the people, my father's Johnson was this thick. My Johnson is four times that thick. You can read it. It's what it says. So I'm not going to take any load off you. I'm going to... Well, Rehoboam thinks that's a better advice. And so he does, and when he does that, the people in the north rebel under Jeroboam, and Jeroboam takes the tribe north, the kingdom north. So there's only two tribes left to make up the southern kingdom of Judah. Jeroboam has a problem, and that is if the people come down to Jerusalem to worship, they'll eventually bend that way politically. He doesn't want that. So as soon as God puts Jeroboam in charge of the 10 northern tribes, he sets up two competing temples in the north. And in those temples, he sets up golden calves from Egypt to be worshipped. When Jeroboam was running from his life in exile from Solomon, he had gone to worship, where he picked up a few habits. So almost immediately, the northern 10 tribes begin to fall away from God. And they do so at a fairly rapid rate. So what happens is you have this, if you read the history of all of this, it's in, you know, 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles. And you have this history of the kings in the north where there's two or three bad kings and then a good king. Two or three bad kings and a good king. And eventually it gets so bad that the prophets tell them that God is going to haul you off into captivity, just to try to get your attention, because you're not paying attention, Israel. And so he says, so what happens is, in 722 he sends Assyria under Tiglath-Pileser, Sennacherib, those kind of people, Sargon, and they haul off the northern kingdom into captivity, from which they never returned. Basically, some of the people were left behind, usually people of no power, authority, wealth, or skill. And then the Assyrians would bring in people from other lands and mingle them in, and they would give these lands to their generals and people so that they became their fiefdoms. And they, by that method, they subjugated the conquered places. So after 721, there is no northern kingdom of Israel. All that's left is the southern kingdom of Judah. Judah's kings are more for the Lord than the kings of the north, but not always for the Lord. So if you read the history of Judah's relationship with God after Solomon, you see good king, bad king, good king, good king, bad king, bad king, good king, good king, bad king, bad king, good king. And one of those good kings, one of the better of them, was a man whose name was Hezekiah. Hezekiah was his father and grandfather before him and his great-grandfather were all kings in Judah. And his great-grandfather and his grandfather were good kings. His father was a lousy king named Ahaz. And he worshipped false gods and sacrificed his children to Moloch and a number of other things. But Hezekiah, who was the son of Ahaz, you can see it in his name really, the way it's spelling everything, who was the son of Ahaz, was fortunate that, like all young princes, he had a major tutor. And his major tutor was a member of the royal family who was older and educated and wise and who could teach him the things he needed to know. And Hezekiah's major tutor was a man named Isaiah, Isaiah the prophet. So because of the teaching of Isaiah the prophet, and you remember, if you are a royal son, the chances of you spending much time with your father are not good. I mean, there's always dozens and dozens of mothers. They've each got dozens and dozens of kids. And there's always some palace plotting going on about who's going to wind up with the throne when it's all over with. And so you don't spend much time with your father. You spend time with whoever's been appointed to be your regent. And in his case, it was Isaiah the prophet. So he was a good king, and he did right before the Lord and did well. And he actually stood up to Assyria when Assyria came calling on the southern kingdom. And the Assyrians assumed that since God had allowed them to haul off the northern kingdom, that he would allow them to haul off the southern kingdom. And, of course, they weren't dealing with God. So the Assyrians are miraculously defeated. They actually defeat themselves. They're basically their soldiers who are made up largely of conscripts from all other nations, get into a drunken brawl one night right before they're supposed to take Jerusalem. And because of the confusion of God in their camp, they wind up killing each other, 185,000 of them, according to the Bible. And when the dust all settles, there's no one. Come on in. When the dust all settles, there's no one, no one to do the fighting. You looking for Daniel?
Yes.
Have a seat.
Thank you.
Yeah, Nancy will help you out. There's no one to do the fighting, and so they pack it up and go home. And once they pack it up and go home, the ruler of Assyria dies. And the Babylonians come into ascendancy. So then, later on, after Hezekiah, there are a couple of bad kings, particularly evil king named Manasseh, and he has a long 50-year reign, and he is very evil. But he has a son whose name is Josiah. Josiah was one of the greatest kings that Israel ever knew. He had a 31-year reign, something like that. And what happened with Josiah was that he had a heart toward God, but he knew nothing about God. And after he became king, he started clearing out the temple. The temple had been turned by Manasseh into a worship place for the Assyrian god. They had taken the altar of the Lord out of the temple and stuck it in a closet. Manasseh said, I might have to seek the Lord sometime, so I don't want to destroy this altar. If I have to seek him, then I'll have his altar because of his pagan practices. And they had put a Babylonian Assyrian altar in there, and they were worshiping Assyrian gods. All kinds of pagan practices going on in there. Josiah cleaned out the temple and started the process of restoring the priesthood according to that which David had laid out in the scriptures. And somebody found the book of Deuteronomy in the mess. They found it. And they read it, and they said, oh, we're in trouble. And so they went and told the king, and he read it. And he said, oh, we're in trouble. And then he gathered the nation together, and he read it to the nation. He said, we are so far from where God has meant us to be that it's a wonder we haven't been hauled off already. So they dedicated themselves to the Lord. He takes down all the high places. He gets rid of all the pagan statues and does all kinds of things and really puts his heart and his people toward following God. And so they have a very strong 20-year or so time frame where they're walking with the Lord. Unfortunately, he gets himself killed in an unwise battle that he wasn't supposed to be in by Nebo, the king of Egypt. And Babylon winds up overcoming Egypt and Israel. And there are two or three short kings after Josiah. And then they all get hauled off in 605 by Nebuchadnezzar into Babylon. The Babylonians hauled them off in three tranches. Three groups of people over time. And in the last group that went out was a young man named Daniel. And that's the setting of our story here. So he goes out. He's 16 years old. He's a member of the royal family, like Isaiah, like we talked about before. He's grown up in the castle, in the capital. He's been trained as any royal family member would. And he was there during the last 14 years of Josiah's reign. He saw the restoration of the book of the law, the restoration of the daily sacrifice. He saw godliness in court and its subsequent decline under Jehoiakim, who was the king that came afterwards. He was a witness to the ministry of Jeremiah. When Jeremiah was prophesying against Israel, he was there. He lived 72 years, as far as we know at least, in exile. And he witnessed the entire 70-year Babylonian captivity. And one of the things we'll get into is that in a vision, God told him exactly how long that captivity was going to last, and among a number of other things, as well as he saw the destruction of Jerusalem. He is one of the few people in the Bible about whom there is no recorded fault or sin. All of God's people are flawed, and all of them have some sort of a problem, or, you know, we're none of us righteous, no, not one. And so there, as by and large, when you study somebody in the Bible, Old or New Testament, you'll find out that they've got some issues somewhere. And fortunately, God relates to us with sin, otherwise he wouldn't relate to anybody. But Daniel, like Joseph, is one of those people about whom there is nothing much recorded, I mean, nothing at all. And you get the impression that Daniel was a friend of God. The ultimate thing that you can achieve in this world is to be a friend of God. It's available to everybody. But Daniel was a friend of God. And he is called beloved by God. God calls him that. And like John the Revelator, who's called beloved, he was given an enormous look into the future of his people and of the world. John the Revelator, who wrote the book of Revelation, the beloved disciple, the youngest disciple of Jesus, was given this huge look into the future, and so was Daniel, both of whom God calls beloved. Like Joseph before the two of them, Daniel has three friends. Daniel and his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, my shack, your shack, and Winnebago, found themselves slaves in an alien and hostile country. Also like Joseph, they went from riches to rags, but they responded with trust in God and perseverance in their faith. In spite of the significant loss and unimaginable trials they went through, which probably, almost certainly, included forced emasculation, because that's the way it was done. We also can see that in the fact that the person who hauled off Daniel and his friends into captivity was the chief of the eunuchs. What happened is that when these kings would take over, they would go and find all these various people in the empire, and they would sort of divide them into groups. And if it was somebody who's likely to revolt against you, they'd be executed. If it was somebody who was young and pretty, they'd go into the harem, or they'd be going to slavery in that regard. If they had wealth, that would be confiscated, and they would take that away. But if they were young, before a certain age, before they got to the place where they were too much invested against your nation, they would very often be hauled off and reinculturated and retrained in the schools of the people who hauled them away. And by this process, they built strong empires, because they basically built empires that were full of people from all different cultures who were very the brightest and the best, and these people would rise to places of prominence. But they would do it young enough so that the person, they have time to basically enculturate them till they were really loyal to the new culture as opposed to the old one. One of the things they would do with the young men is to castrate them, almost without fail, because for one thing, it prevented them from becoming overly aggressive in response and rebellion, and it also allowed them free access throughout the castle, the palace, I should say, especially the harem area, which was, when you got 500 wives, is a little bit everywhere, and so that was regularly done, and frankly was done at some level even as far as much as the 1400s. A.D. And that was Daniel's story, as well as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Their response to all of this was trust in God and perseverance and faith. Y'all remember the story of Joseph, which is another story all in of itself. Joseph gets sold by his brothers into slavery. He gets hauled off to captivity into Egypt. He's put in as the slave of the head of the head jailer, the head of the guard for Potiphar. And there, he refuses to bow down to Egypt's gods and is faithful to his own God, even concerning what he would eat or not eat. When it did not look like he would survive long, except he had an extraordinary gift for administration, and very soon Potiphar began to realize that whatever he put Joseph in charge of prospered, until eventually Joseph was in charge of everything Potiphar owned. The only thing that he wasn't in charge of was Potiphar's wife, who attempted to seduce him. And being faithful to his God, he refused to do that. She accused him. He was then thrown into prison for some years, whereupon he becomes the head of the prison. The head of the prison realizes he's got a great gift, and before you know it, he's running the prison and having dreams and visions. Eventually, through a series of circumstances, he gets promoted to be the second most powerful man in all of Egypt, because he understands what the future is going to bring. He's been told about the years of famine that are going to come after the years of plenty, and he basically sets Egypt up to be the dominant world power through the management of the resources during years of plenty, so that at the time of the famine, worldwide famine, all the nations are coming up and basically giving everything they have to Pharaoh. And that's the story of Joseph. It's also the story of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That of all the people who are in his shoes, they respond in this time of difficulty with trust in God and faithfulness to what it is that God has them to do. Their faithfulness and trust are rewarded by God's miraculous support. That's the story of Daniel. As we read it, we're going to see that. By his sustaining presence in the midst of their trials, we'll see that as well, resulting in what the Bible refers to as that peace that passes understanding, the almost miraculous sense of well-being in the midst of all that's going bad. That's how God manifests himself among his friends. And by a significant level of wisdom and vision, as I said before, Daniel and his friends are just an example of these kinds of people in the Bible down through the Old and New Testament. Again, in similar fashion to Joseph, Daniel's prophetic gifts promote him to the highest echelons of the ever-changing transitional governments of the Babylonians, the Medes, and the Persians. Now, much like Europe, between right before World War I and World War II, almost all of the ancient world was being ruled out of the same set of families. Uncle Joe has media, has the Media, and Uncle Sam has Persia, and Uncle John has Babylonia, etc., etc. It wasn't quite that well. That's the way it was in England and France and Germany during the early 1900s, up until the time of Hitler, actually. But so what you have is a whole bunch of transition as one group diminishes and the other group emerges in power. So you have the Egyptians, which are overcome by the Assyrians, which are overcome by the Babylonians, who are overcome by the Medes, overcome by the Persians. The Persians are eventually overcome by Alexander the Great. You get the story of Esther, for instance, from the transition between the Persians and the Greeks of Alexander. And so that's the world that he's living in. And Daniel finds himself being in charge and in a position of high leadership throughout those transitions. The kings all change, but Daniel never does. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego maintain their positions of leadership, guidance, and authority with all these empires as they come along. Now, in each case, they've got to be chosen and selected by the new king, but they always are. They always are because of the way they act and behave, which we shall see. And part of the story of Daniel is that it encourages us to behave right, to do the right things, to be motivated and operate in the right things. You wonder sometimes why people have vision. And the reason they have vision is because of their relationship with the Lord. And we'll see in Daniel's case why that is the case. His witness and testimony converted enemies to allies, pagans to followers of God. His wisdom brought him before kings and endured through the ages, even to the end of time. Daniel's wisdom, his visions, are working themselves out even today and are recognized as such. There's a lot of people back in 500, 600, 700 B.C. that had ideas about what the future would hold. But their plans are all in the dust somewhere. Nobody's paying attention to them. He served Nebuchadnezzar, Nabonidus, Belshazzar, Darius, and Cyrus as a significant counselor, often as a high official. And his influence led three Persian wise men to the house. It should say house, not stable, because by the time the wise men get there, Jesus is in a house. But the house in Bethlehem, bearing gifts to a newborn king, a full half century after his death. So the prophecies of Daniel were being studied by the Chaldean astrologers even after Daniel was gone. His influence in his society was such that they revered his writings. Daniel writes in a literary style known as apocalyptic writing. The word apocalypsis, which is the Greek word, for instance, for the book of Revelation, the Greek title for the book of Revelation is called apocalypsis. The word apocalypsis means to reveal by hiding. What it means is that you're writing something so that people can understand it, but you're writing it in a way that only certain people can understand it. Because, usually in order to protect yourself from getting killed. What happens is that people have buzzwords, people have idioms that they use, and they know what they mean, that other people would not know. And so what happens is that when you're talking among yourselves, in the presence of your enemies, you use those terms in ways that mean something to you, but not to the other person. It's called plausible deniability. Any lawyers in the room? It's called plausible deniability, okay? For instance, let's say that we were taken over by an alien race from outer space, okay? They said they had it all clamped down, and what we were trying to do is to mount a counterinsurgency to try to, you know, take over our world back, and we needed to get to the weapons depot and all that sort of thing. So you're sitting around a coffee table one morning, and you're talking to your friends about how the raid went on the Army depot, you know, the night before. How did it go? And you know, all of these aliens are sitting around you. So you look at the guy across and you say, how was the game last night? He says, well, we got a triple, but not the home run. He said, that's a shame. We could have used that home run. You know, so what you're saying is that we were able to get in, we got out all this stuff, but we didn't get the big weapon that we really needed. You are speaking apocalyptically. You're speaking in code. And so apocalyptic writing is full of code, and it includes things like the book of Daniel, the book of Revelation, several of the other prophets, etc. The thing about this code is that to the people who understand what the words mean, it's simple and clear. The book of Revelation was a piece of cake for the Jews of the first century. They knew exactly what it meant. Our problem is that we don't speak their language anymore, not just Hebrew and Aramaic. We don't use their idioms, their buzzwords. You looking for Daniel?
Nope.
Okay.
Thank you.
You found Daniel. All right. The apocalyptic writing is designed to encourage persecuted believers to have faith and endure. It's written because people are subjugated, and you're trying to encourage them, usually as a leadership, person of leadership, you're trying to encourage them to hang in there. It's going to be okay. And so you write in such a way that it can be published around for people to see it, but you won't get massacred for treason. And it tells them to have faith and endure until the manifestation of the victory of God on their behalf. It's used to protect the writer from political or physical lethal retribution. Gulliver's Travels, for instance, was a book written against European governance. And if you read Gulliver's Travels, you could take it as a child's story. But if you really understood what it meant, he was making fun of that same family of rulers I was talking about. The Lilliputtons and all the Yahoos and all this kind of stuff. Well, the average person on the street who read this, you know, they went, "Do you get that? He's talking about the frogs. You know, he's talking about the Brits. He's whatever." They knew that. But then if someone were to accuse him, he'd go, "It's just a kid's story. It's just a kid's story. It's not. It's kind of like the absolute certainty that everybody had that Puff the Magic Dragon was about marijuana, and Peter, Paul, and Mary's insistence that it was just a kid's song. So, you know, who knows? People thought they knew. Animal Farm was written the same way against Soviet communism, to say the things that these writers, Jonathan Swift, wanted to say, for instance, openly would have gotten himself executed or exiled or something worse. It claims to have revelations similar to that claimed by the prophets, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Paul, John, etc. So always apocalyptic writing of biblical nature will claim to have special revelation from God. The messages are initially encoded. The patient reader will be able to translate the code further within the text. The thing about Daniel is, and you have to remember that most of these people didn't sit down and write a book. Isaiah didn't sit down one day and said, "I'm going to write a bestseller." Isaiah wrote a series of sermons, many of them. Somewhere along the line, they got all put together, glommed together, and put together in a book. They actually got put together in ways that weren't... Hey! They actually got put together in... We have a visit from Mark Danzy. That's good. We actually got put together in a way that wasn't exactly orderly. You know, somebody's carrying a big stack of these things. They fall on the floor. They go, oops, they pick them back up. So if you're reading some of these writings, they're actually out of sync, well, which we talk about in the classes. And so what happens is that in some of the sermons and whatever letters that he's writing, the code is explained to one group, but not to another. And it's only when you put them side by side and read them together that you can see that. So as we read the book of Daniel, we're going to find it easy to understand the code, because he almost always tells us in a later chapter, sometimes sooner than later, what the code means. Daniel's not in the kind of perilous position that John was. John, the apostle who's on the Isle of Patmos, is the bishop of all Asia Minor, particularly the seven major churches of Asia Minor to whom he's writing in the book of Revelation. And he's on the Isle of Patmos because they just didn't want to kill him. He's been exiled there, and he's been put there to keep from directing his people and teaching them the kinds of treason that he's been teaching his people, like there is another king called Jesus. And there's another empire called the Kingdom of Heaven, etc., etc. And if he were to tell the people what he wanted to tell them in a straightforward manner, in an epistle or a letter, they would take him out and slaughter him. And so he writes an apocalyptic. That's what he does. So John's letters are harder to decode because he's much more careful about where he puts that information. You have to actually go to the books of the prophets to find his code. The average Roman would not have that access to that. Daniel's not quite as careful about that. Apocalyptic is a style rich in dreams and visions, with implications in its own time and reverberations to the end of time. Now, one of the things that we learn when we study biblical prophecy is that biblical prophecy is always true in layers, meaning it's true now at a certain level, it's true later at another level, and it's true ultimately at a bigger level. So there are things that when these prophets write that they're talking about things that are going to happen now. Like sometimes they're talking about the fall of the city, the fall of Israel, the city of Jerusalem in 70 AD. But they're also talking in a bigger scale about the restoration of Israel in 48. Or even further out, the destruction of the Antichrist at the time of the second coming of Christ. And so these prophecies have layers. They're good. Part of this is for this, part of this is for later, and part of this is whatever. And the trick is to understand the layers. And it becomes pretty obvious once you see what's going on, but you realize that it's written that way. God is efficient. Its message from God says, I am in control, even though it does not always appear to be so. The enemy, who is over, got a thumb on your head, is defeated. He just doesn't know it yet. If you will take the long view, you will see it. If you will be trusting and faithful, and if you will endure to the end, you'll be very glad that you did. That is always the message of apocalyptic writing. God encouraging people to have faith in the midst of the difficulty, because they'll be glad when they come back, when the teacher comes back from the classroom, that they weren't caught in the spitball fight. Don't always think the teacher's going to come back, but she always does. You know, Jesus told a number of parables about a man who went away on a journey, but then he came back to judge the people and how they behaved while he was gone. Jesus told numerous parables along those lines. He told parables that said, this is what you ought to be doing while I'm gone. These are the gifts and talents I've given you. You ought to be using these. We're all supposed to live in the expectation of the soon coming of the Lord. It's good motivation. And one day it'll be true for some generation. Daniel made well over 100 prophecies and claims with such specificity that skeptics have challenged its authority. The egghead PhDs and religious departments today will tell you that it must have been written after his time because it's too accurate to have been written before his time. The same thing said about Isaiah, for instance. Isaiah prophesied that there would be a man come, Cyrus, who would come and he would restore the people from captivity and bring them home. Isaiah prophesied that in 740 to 730, 728, somewhere in there. And he was talking about a captivity that hadn't even happened yet. And that there would be a man named Cyrus who would be raised up by God and he would allow the people to come home. He called him Cyrus by name 150 years before Cyrus was born. And so the egghead philosophers will say, well, that can't happen. That doesn't make sense. It doesn't happen. It must have been written after all this happened. That's the only explanation. Their basic argument is it didn't happen because it can't happen. Since it can't happen, it didn't happen. Don't you get that? The idea that there actually might be a God, and he could actually reveal that to somebody, just never came into their pea-picking hearts, as Tennessee Ernie Ford used to say. How could you be that accurate? Chronologically, Daniel should be read chapters 1 through 4, 7, 8, 5, 6, 9, 10, and 12. If you're reading Daniel chronologically, that's how you would read them. We're not going to read them chronologically, but if you're trying to figure out the chronology of what's going on, that's the way it would sort itself out. The book of Daniel has two main emphases. It talks about the age of the Gentiles, which is chapters 2 through 7, written in Aramaic, and then it talks about the age of the Jew, or the Hebrew, which are chapter 1 and 8 through 12. Paul said that there was a great mystery hidden in ages, the age of the Gentile church. And it's very important because even though it was floating around among the prophets, people didn't pick up on it. The Jews of Jesus' day never expected that the kingdom of God would be offered to the Gentiles. It was not, they couldn't happen. They were the chosen people. You know what, we're Americans. I mean, we're Israelites. We're always going to be on top and whatever. We deserve it because we're basically good. And it never happened. Jesus said to them, you know, I have children that you don't know. He said, I have come to bring light to the world at large. He said, my God can raise up children of Abraham from rocks in the street. et cetera. Of course, they didn't get that and a lot of other things. Daniel gives us a glimpse at the mystery of the age to come, which is the age of the Gentile church. And it becomes important in the book of Daniel because it separates two very important events that Daniel talks about, the first coming of Christ and the second coming of Christ, with the age of the Gentile being the divider in the middle. And so that's the way the book of Daniel lays itself out. Let me stop and see if there's comments or questions or... Now, if you don't say something, I'll go right on. In the way, in the case of Daniel, when he is prophesying, he does indeed know that. Yeah, he uses terms that explain this. When we get to them, we'll get to it. Shemayim, Shayim. I can't even say it anymore. I'll say it when I get there because I'll read it. But is a term that means 490 years. We'll get to it. He knew exactly what he was saying. And John knows what he's saying too in the book of Revelation. He knows when he's talking about the destruction of Israel, Jerusalem, 70 AD. He knows when he's talking about the fall of the Roman Empire. And he knows when he's talking about the fall of the Antichrist. Our trick is to figure out when he's talking about those things. In Daniel's case, he gives us a lot of pathways. He names the four great kingdoms that are going to be coming one upon the other by name. Gives us their national symbols before some of them even existed. He's pretty freighted with meaning, we say. He's got a load on.
Do you think Daniel had any idea that time was going to progress to this day and age, back in that?
Well, he could see as far as Jesus' lifetime. And then he could see that there would be a period beyond Jesus' lifetime before the second coming. He didn't know how long that period would be. But he could see that far. In fact, he prophesies the exact year that Jesus comes and is crucified from where he sits. And we're able to track from where he sits, from the event that he speaks of, the exact year that Jesus is crucified. Now, he does that before the king who actually starts that process is even born. But he does that. So he can see that far into the future. And beyond, but not how far beyond.
Wasn't it Daniel that talked about, maybe it's another interpretation, about the time frame was about 1,260 years? Something like that.
No. You're talking about the 1,260 days of the 3.5 years of the Great Tribulation. Yeah, that's... He does talk about that, but that's not years. Those are days that has to do with the 7-year period of a tribulation in the second half called the Great Tribulation, which is 1260. And we'll get into all of that because there's mechanisms for us to understand what all those things mean. Now, one thing you got to realize is when you're in the ancient world, you're dealing with a language that's not exact, that has almost no numerical system that's exact. Hebrew is pictorial as a language. It's like cave writing. In fact, in Israel, they don't do contracts in Hebrew because it's not exact enough to do contracts. They do them in French or sometimes English. So when you look at Hebrew, every Hebrew word is a 3-consonant word that's a vowel. I mean, that's a verb. And then you hang pictures on it. You hang other things on it in order to give it meaning. In the ancient world, they had neither punctuation, capitalization, or paragraphs. No commas, no nothing. So when you would start reading Hebrew, you'd start over here on the right and you'd just read left, one capital letter after another straight on through, and you would have to figure out what it was saying by the context in which it was given. A good example, for instance, how that would be working in the Greek of Jesus' day. Paul said, I would not have you ignorant, brethren. Well, what he said was, I would not have you ignorant, brethren, but there's no comma there. You have to figure that out. Or another time, Paul says, let the thief steal, no longer let him labor. Well, actually, what he says is, let the thief steal no longer, comma, let him labor. But that comma wasn't there. When we started off, people say, well, I've read the Bible. If you've read the Bible, you've read Hebrew, Greek, and Aramaic. Because anything else you're reading is a translation. Translations are written by some really, really good people who have brought their knowledge and years of study together to give us an understanding of what this means. And most of the time, they get it pretty close. When they disagree, they're not off by much from each other. But most of the time, they get it right.
And most of us grew up with King James Version as kids.
Yeah, yeah.
Now today,
yeah, the one that Jesus used. There's actually churches in this town that are called King James only churches. They advertise it on their billboards. Not just in this town, they're all over the South. That unless you use the King James Version, you're a heretic. And they are fond of saying the one that Paul used. You know, now the thing is King James Version was written in 1611 AD. Okay? The King James Version of the Bible is the most politicized version of the Bible ever written. And it has more flaws and errors in it from a political point of view than any other translation, for the very serious reason that the Huguenot King of Scotland, James I, was given the English throne. And he was trying to rule the English people, and the Anglican bishops were in the way. They were constantly telling him, don't believe what he says. The Bible says speaks against what he's saying. Well, these people couldn't read. There was everybody who had written an English Bible up until that time had been burned at the stake. Huss and Wycliffe and all these people. So King James authorizes the translation of the Latin Jerome New Testament Bible into English. And so they set about to convert Jerome over into English. And whenever they would get to a place where the Anglican bishops, who were looking over their shoulder, didn't like what they said, they would have a fight. And so the Anglican bishops would refuse to give what was called the nihil obstat, or the imprimatur, which means nihil obstat, nothing stands in the way. Imprimatur means you have permission to print. They wouldn't give these authorities to them to print these things, if they didn't agree with the text. And the Anglican bishops could only get fussy at a certain level, but it was a fussy level at times. For instance, when they got to the word baptize, the Greek word baptizo, it means to immerse. And so when Jesus said, go out and baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, it says immersing them. And the Huguenots were going to translate it immersing them. Well, the Anglicans didn't believe in immersion baptism. They were actually other groups of Protestants who did, and they were considered heretics by the Brits. In fact, there was a group of Protestants in Germany called the Dunkers, because their main focus was on baptism. Okay, in fact, there was a 30-year war fought over baptism in Germany and Switzerland. So what happened is that the Huguenots are going to translate this immerse. The Anglican bishops refuse to accept the word immerse. They want sprinkle or pour. Of course, it doesn't mean that, and so the Huguenots refused to give it. So the compromise was they take the Greek word baptizo, they anglicize it. They make an English word out of it for the first time in history in 1611, baptize. Because up until that time, he would have been John the Immerser, not John the Baptist. The word baptize didn't exist before the 1611 translation. And so what happens is you use the word baptize, or you translate it the way you translate it, and you translate what you translate, and we got a compromise. There were all kinds of compromises like this throughout the King James. Another one that's fairly significant is that there is a word called Sheol, which is the place of the dead, not to be confused with heaven or hell. It was the place that the dead went, all dead went, before Christ was raised from the dead and opened the gates of heaven, and it's the place where all the dead not in Christ are still today. However, the Greek word for that is Hades. And Hades just means Sheol, the place of the dead. The King James people believed that Hades was the same as hell. And the reason they believed that was because of Dante's Inferno. Most of the issues, or most of the things that people grew up thinking about hell as a place of fire where you're flipping people like burrs and there's seven layers and the lawyers in the worst layer and all this kind of stuff, and Satan is the king of hell, all of that kind of conversation comes from Dante's Inferno. It doesn't come from the Bible. Yeah, that's right. They were selling indulgences to keep people out of purgatory, which is another invention in hell. But anyway, so the point is that everywhere that the Bible said Hades, the King James, Anglican bishops required them to insert hell. So if you take any other translation besides the King James Bible, and you set it besides the King James Bible, and you flip through wherever it says hell, in many of those cases, it won't say hell, it'll say Hades. It'll say hell other places because that means hell, but it doesn't mean it there. And so we get these kinds of notions.
That also, one of the examples that I think you heard before is on the commandments, thou shalt not kill versus thou shalt not murder.
Yeah, the thou shalt not kill versus thou shalt not murder is really just an understanding of the language and the culture. I mean, you know, you have to think about this. God has got them killing all kinds of people and things. So he can't be against killing in and of itself. He's against murder. And when you read it in the Hebrew, it means thou shalt not murder. But the people of his day, they knew what he meant. You know, they knew that he meant you shall not kill this way. I mean, you have to remember that Moses gave him a law that said if someone accidentally killed your son, you know, whether by accident or on purpose, that they could flee to one of the seven cities of refuge. And if they were able to make it to one of the seven cities of refuge before the Avenger of Blood caught up with them, then they would be allowed sanctuary there for as long as the high priest was alive, after which they could go home and you weren't allowed to touch them. So if they didn't, if you caught them before they got there, then Moses and the law condoned your avenging the blood of your murdered son by killing that person. You got to remember that before Moses came along, the basic law of justice in the ancient world was called lex talionis, the law of retaliation. And what happened was that if someone knocked out your tooth, you'd slit his throat, his wife's throat, his kid's throat, whatever. Moses came along and he said, we can't do that anymore. God, that's not pleasing to God. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. You shall not take more than an eye for an eye. You shall not take more than a tooth for a tooth. It's wrong to murder everybody's house, cat, and dog over an eye or a tooth. And so Moses brought in this liberalizing principle of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. We tend to think of it as being pretty conservative, but it was actually very liberalizing. Now, what most people don't realize is that almost always that eye for an eye was translated into a monetary value. They would go to the high priest, he'd say, okay, this eye is worth 85 shekels. You know, this tooth is worth whatever. And so they would wind up paying a monetary value rather than an eye and the tooth for a tooth. Of course, you don't get all that kind of story when people are trying to tell you how evil Moses was. All right, I'm afield. But what time is it? All right, we are here till 7:30. All right.
Can I ask you one other question?
Yeah, please.
Break point there. This is so far off the wall, it's ridiculous. I have to put it up because I've seen documentaries on Nostradamus.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that he had documented so many things, and people would try to get time with him because he would then predict what's going on. Or
yeah.
He could find what's ailing them.
Yeah.
I mean, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
What's that like?
Well, all right.
Is that too far afield?
No, I'll go there just for a minute. The Bible says that the gifts and call of God are irrevocable, and that God gives gifts to his people, spiritual gifts. In Romans 12, it talks about the nine spiritual gifts that are given to people. And there's many other gifts that are referred to in Paul's epistles, beyond wisdom, knowledge, faith, tongues, interpretation tongues, discernment of spirits, all that sort of thing. There's nine of those gifts, but there's all these others, like administrations, helps, hospitality. These are gifts. So all of us are given gifts by God. And the scripture says that the gifts and call of God are irrevocable. In other words, he gives you the gift, and if you're a good person, you use them for good. If you're a bad person, you use them for bad. And for instance, Billy Graham said the most charismatic man he'd ever heard in his life, or been around in his life, was Bill Clinton. And he said if Bill Clinton would give himself to the preaching of the gospel, that he could be a great evangelist because he's so gifted. He's so charismatic when he speaks. And it's true. Whether you like Bill Clinton or you don't like Bill Clinton or what he stands for, he is so winsome to be around. You take a guy like Newt Gingrich, for instance, who may be a bit more of a right thinker, but he's obnoxious to be around. And, you know, you almost have to like him in spite of himself because he's so arrogant and pugnacious. So at any rate, the gifts and call of God are irrevocable. Some of you have got a little bit of time on you. Remember Elmer Gantry, the story of Elmer Gantry. It's the story of a person who has a great preaching ministry, but he winds up using it for selfish ends and purposes. It's a novel. At any rate, that's gone on forever in history. You have people who were supposed to be using their gifts and call for God, but they didn't. They used them for evil purposes. Another person who was extraordinarily charismatic, a person who had the ability to lead people and to cause them to rally to him and to believe what he said, Adolf Hitler. He was, you know, he was a wallpaper hanger with a fourth grade education from Bavaria, with Jewish ancestors, and yet he rises to this particular to the heights of all this kind of stuff. So gifts and call of God are irrevocable in the scriptures. In the book of Kings, there is a story of about a man named Balaam the prophet. Balaam is a prophet of God. He's a prophet like Isaiah is a prophet, and Elijah was a prophet, and all these other prophets. He's a prophet of God. But Balaam had an evil streak in him. I mean, not an evil streak. He was greedy. He wanted money. And he wanted power. And so even though Balaam's gift was from God, it could be bought. And so while the people of Israel were crossing into Moab, and Moabites and Midianites hired Balaam to come and prophesy against Israel. Well, Balaam didn't want to do that because he knew that God wouldn't like it. But they offered him enough money that he decided to go anyway. So he goes over there and he says, I'm probably not going to be able to prophesy against them. God probably won't let me say anything against them. But he said, you know, they said, well, try this. So he prophesies and he blesses them. They said, that's no good. Let's go to another place. Maybe you can do it better from that place. He prophesies, he blesses them, whatever. Anyway, he's ultimately unable to curse Israel as they want him to. And he, you know, and they said, well, you know, we should just take your head off for this. I'm paraphrasing. And he says, well, I can tell you how to get them, though. I can't prophesy against them, but I can tell you how to get them. And the way you get them is you sneak up next to them like you're their friends, intermarry with them, and over time you'll lead them astray. They'll become like you. And that's exactly what they do. And so in the book of Hebrews, we're told that Israel was totally led astray by Balaam and his false use of his gift. So, somebody like Nostradamus, does he have a real gift? He could. He could indeed. I've not spent a lot of time around Nostradamus to look at what he says. He spoke in quatrains, which are poetic verses in certain orders. And in those quatrains, he said a lot of things that were really nonspecific. And people look at them and they say, that looks like the Kennedy assassination. Well, somebody else looks at the same one and they say, no, that looks like the Archduke Ferdinand. And so he's almost speaking Rorschachs. You know, Rorschachs, you got this guy who's sitting down with his psychiatrist because he's a terrible person. And his psychiatrist goes, oh, here, children, inkblot. He says, what do you see? He says, I see a naked female. He goes, okay, what do you see here? I see a naked female. He said, what do you see? I see a naked female. He says, boy, you sure got a dirty mind. He said, well, you're one of the dirty pictures. the point is that Nostradamus spoke so vaguely that people can take, I mean, people take the Bible and sort of bend it to what they want it to say as well. So, is he gifted? Very well could have been. There were lots of people like this in his day. I mean, there are lots of people like that in every age. Was he from God? He certainly wasn't committed to God. God was not, he was not a godly man. So if he was gifted, he was using it for his own purposes. Other comments?
I'm
No, that's right. That's right.
Things can be revealed satanically, and you have to look at it, is it for good, and is it a profit for God, or is it not so good?
Yeah.
From what I read, I mean, Satan rules this world. It says that from day one, he rules this world. So.
Yeah, he's... all right, so let's... I agree with you. Okay. Daniel 1. In the third year, you haven't missed much, Kingsley. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and the nobles, youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding, discerning knowledge, who had the ability for serving the king's court. He ordered them to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank. He appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were entering the king's personal service. Now among them were the sons of Judah, from the sons of Judah, were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. To Daniel he assigned the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and Azariah Abednego. All right, conquering monarchs, we talked about this, took the best and the brightest of the young people from noble families, trained them to work in their courts and administration. They fed them well, they educated them, and re-indoctrinated them, acculturated them, to prepare them to serve among the nobility. The males were often castrated to ensure docility, to allow them to serve in the harems of the nobility. They functioned as trophy slaves, performed tasks concerning inappropriate or undesirable things were inappropriate, undesirable for the citizens of the land. If you have a country, for instance, that doesn't believe that that garbage is polluting, you can take somebody this and make him a garbage collector, because you know. But anyway, things they didn't want to do or couldn't do. Daniel and his three friends were educated for 3 years and put into the king's personal service. They made it out of the class. They received offensive Babylonian deity names. Daniel, whose name was God is my judge, was changed to Belteshazzar, which means the treasury of Bel's secrets. Bel is Baal, the god of Baal, false god. So he was named not after his god, but after a false god. Hananiah, he to whom the Lord is gracious, was named Shadrach, let the sun god preserve us from evil. Mishael, who comes from God, was named Meshach, which means he belongs to Shishak. And Azariah, the Lord is my helper, was named Abednego, which means the servant of Nego. So these Jewish boys who were faithful to Yahweh were given names, and every time they had told somebody what their name was, they were saying, my name is the treasury of Baal. I'm named after Shishak, the god, you know. They were given these names, which was no small matter to them, I'm sure. Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. You know, you got to pick your battles. But what he wouldn't do is eat these things that God had forbidden them to eat. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. So his attitude is not to just rebel, but to ask permission to not be able to do this. Now, God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. The commander of the officials said to Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king, who has appointed your food and your drink. So the food that you guys eat every day was appointed by the king for you to eat. Now, the king is basically giving them what they would consider the best of their foods. It would be high-end food. It would be really good food. But it might be food that was offensive to a Jew to eat. So he said, I'm afraid of the king. He has appointed your food. For why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youth of your own age? If you don't eat this food, you're not going to look as good as the people around you. You're not going to glisten, you know, and whatever. And then he's going to say to me, what's wrong with these four here? Why not there? Why are they looking so scruffy? And then I'd say, well, I'm letting them eat, you know, other foods. That's why you lose your job. He's already lost more than his job. Remember, he's the chief of the eunuchs. All right. Daniel said to the overseer, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servant for 10 days and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be observed in your presence and the appearance of the youths who are eating king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So these young men had grown up during the spiritual revival under Josiah. They had read the book of Deuteronomy. They were firmly committed to keep the book of Deuteronomy after having seen what all Israel had gone through. Their attitude was, is if I have to violate my covenant with God, I'm willing to die. It's called the conscience clause. You always say no to authority as long as you're willing to pay the price. And they sought to remain faithful to Yahweh even in captivity. They endeavored to keep the Jewish dietary laws. They properly exercised the conscience clause. Now, they went at it in the right way. They used wisdom. Remember, these are people that God is giving wisdom to. So they use wisdom. Now, you got to remember that these four were among a larger group that had been brought in and put in this program. And I think it's probably safe to assume that a number of those people in that group were a little less peaceful about what all had happened to them. Bitter. Some of them probably had checked themselves out or gotten themselves thrown out, tossed out by this particular time. And others of them found it easy just to go along with what's happening, you know. Eat, drink, and be merry, folks, for tomorrow we die. Our God is tanked, you know. He didn't save us. But not these four. Although we are supposed to obey governing authorities, there is a proper way to rebel against immoral or unjust commandments. Jesus set up the religious leaders of his day, and he accepted death for it. Peter and John showed the same righteous rebellion, respectful rebellion, in Acts 4. In Acts 18, we get a story where Jesus and John are in the temple, and they run across a man who is lame, who's at the temple gate. He's been there for many, many years. That's his begging spot. So what happens is that they ask, he's holding up his bowl for alms, and Peter says to him, "Silver and gold have I none, but such as I have give I thee. In the name of Jesus Christ, rise up and walk." And if you've ever been around Sunday school, they went walking and leaping and praising God. Okay. So when this guy gets up and starts walking and jumping around the place and hooting and hollering, people who've known him all of his life, who see that he's been healed, rush to find out what it's all about, and Peter delivers his second great sermon in a couple of weeks, the first one being the one after Pentecost. And Peter gets up and he delivers that sermon that only Peter can deliver. "You killed the Messiah, but it's okay because you were stupid." That is the theme of Peter's sermon. Read it, you'll see that's what it is. You talk about a guy who can get away with saying anything. But that is his theme, and he brings it out. So he does, and once again, many people come to know the Lord. However, he's doing this in the temple again, and the people, leaders in the temple haul him off and bring him in, and they threaten he and John, who they see as ignorant Galilean fishermen, that they should not preach like this, and they shouldn't preach in the temple. They shouldn't be talking about Jesus, who was a criminal, etc., etc. And, you know, they don't get anywhere with them. And so they put them out while they have a council and decide what to do with them. One of the things that, of course, is suggested is they just kill them. You know, we've already killed his master, I'll kill a few more. But Gamaliel, who's one of the most respected of the Pharisaical teachers, who is Paul's teacher, suggests to them that a good way to start a really good rebellion is to keep this process of killing people. And he points out to them that there were other messiahs that had popped up from time to time in their recent lifetime. And that when left to their own devices, they soon dwindled away to nothing. And so Gamaliel persuades them not to kill Peter and John. So they bring them back in, and it says, when they had summoned them, verse 18, they commanded them not to speak or teach at all in the name of Jesus. But Peter and John answered and said to them, "Whether it is right in the sight of God to give heed to you rather than to God, you be the judge. For we cannot stop speaking what we have seen and heard." So basically they're saying, you can do with this what you will, but we will not stop preaching in the name of Jesus. Now the Sanhedrin was their religious authority. The Sanhedrin was the authority given to them by God, and all Jews were supposed to obey the Sanhedrin. But nobody's supposed to obey anybody who commands them to violate the laws of God. And so what happens is you have to respectfully decline and be willing to pay the price. I knew a man from Louisville who did that some years ago, where Louisville's where we were born up. His name was Cassius Clay. Daniel and his companions' behavior and their attitudes apparently give them favor with Ashpenaz, who is the supervisor of the eunuchs. He is inclined to go along with these guys. He likes them. I don't know how long they've been there, but already he thinks well of them. The scripture says, when a man's ways are pleasing to the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. They humbly sought permission to eat God's required diet. They accept against the consequences of their civil disobedience should Yahweh fail to support their stance. They resisted respectfully and without attitude. And this is not the last time it happens in this story. We're going to see this again and again. They resisted respectfully without attitude. In this regard, their behavior mirrored that of Joseph, who was a captive in Egypt. Verse 14, so he, that's Ashpenaz, listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, their appearance seemed better and they were fatter than the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. So the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and wine that they were to drink and give them vegetables instead. So I think that's pretty self-explanatory.
That was miraculous.
Huh?
That was miraculous for them to get fat on vegetables.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, actually, we would probably find that... you got to remember that prior to Noah's flood, the entire earth lived on vegetables. You know, nobody was eating... Nobody was legally eating meat prior to Noah's flood. So you can live on vegetables if you... Of course, you got to remember the vegetables that we have today are not our grandmother's vegetables. They're... You know, they've been processed and whatever. I mean, you know, you take a piece of squash, you peel it, and throw the rinds down the sink, and you've thrown the best part away. And then it's been processed and whatever. One of the reasons we have so many of the diseases at levels that our forefathers did not have is because we've destroyed our food. What we eat doesn't sustain us. And so we're spending millions of dollars every year on supplements to try to put back in what the food used to give us. I've gone to preaching, so I'll get off of that. And I like a good hamburger myself. Anyway, so this small victory, see, God came through for them, and they were allowed to keep the covenant. Ashpenaz then agreed to honor their request. Honor begets honor in honorable opponents. It's an important principle that we would do well to understand in our country today. There was a time when people of absolute diverse opinion could stand up and debate the issues quite strongly and still greet each other warmly afterwards. They didn't have to hate each other in the process of disagreeing. So this small victory that we see here in this first chapter is the beginning of a significant witness of four young men to a monolithic pagan court full of intrigue and evil. Solomon warns us that it is the little foxes that spoil the vineyard. What he means by that is that you build hedges around your vineyard keep the animals out, but the hedges have little gaps at the bottom. And it's the little foxes that get in and spoil the vineyard. It is the little things that we give in on that wind up polluting us and corrupting us and whatever. You know, we're really big on, you know, I will not commit adultery. But then we let those other little things slide in that actually wind up polluting us. Zechariah 4 says, "Do not despise the day of small beginnings." This little event here about the food is the beginning of everything we're going to read that comes afterwards. As for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. So they were smart to begin with, and God blessed their studies, and they got to be the brightest of the brightest in their class. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. It turned out, as they were going along, that Daniel would be daily able to interpret people's dreams and visions. People would say, "I had this dream," and whatever. And Daniel would say, "Well, this is what I think God was saying by that." And it would turn out to be true. And he develops a rep for being able to read dreams. Another guy who did that was a man named Joseph, if you remember that story. Then at the end of the days, which the king had specified for presenting them, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king talked with them, and out of them all, not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. So when the class was presented before the king, their grades and everything were brought forward, their look and everything was examined. The four that stood out were these four guys, and of this whole class, they're brought directly into the king's service, which means that everybody else got other jobs of lesser nature. But they were brought right to the top, which, by the way, is a double-edged sword. Because when you get too close to the top, you're also close to the fire. One of the things that Solomon says is, when you sit at the cave table of a king, put your knife to your throat lest his delicacies consume you. What he means by that is we get around people who are high, and sometimes we just start blabbing away. And before you know it, we're revealing everything there is to reveal. And we're better off to kind of keep our mouth shut in front of high people, is what Solomon's saying. So these guys, they were brought into the king's service. As for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and the conjurers who were in all his realm. And Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king. So he continues in this role all the way up to Cyrus the Persian, which is 70 some odd years later after Cyrus the Persian we talked about before. Now, in the ancient world, and actually it's not just an ancient principle, but many people lead this way, I think wisely this way, and that is when you're in charge, you're the ultimate decider, you have to make a decision. And it all hinges on what you do and the well-being of the country or the company or the family, or whether it's all depending on your decision. You can take one of several approaches. You can say, I got the job, I must be smart, and you can just go do whatever you want. And then when it crashes and burns, there you are. Or you can say, well, all right, I got to make this decision, but I'd be curious to know what you think about this, especially since you manage this department and you know something about it more than I would ever know. A wise leader is someone who asks people who have the information to advise him on what it is they see and think. And then he sorts through all that to try to determine what truth is. And that's the way these kings operated. That's one of the reasons why they had all these people brought in from these different cultures. You know, for instance, let's suppose on a very small level that there developed a problem among the Jews in the empire. Well, he's got four Jewish kids here. Who grew up in that empire, and he came and said, look, I'm having a problem over here in Susa with the Jews in Susa, and they're this and that. They're doing this and whatever, you know, whatever. What can you advise me about that? And Daniel would say, well, here's the deal. You know, they're actually asking them to run the rib shack over there, and, you know, that's against their religion. You know, tell them to run the kumquash stand, and they'll be fine. So that kind of thing can be very, very good, and that's what this guy does. So God rewards their faithfulness with extraordinary wisdom and favor in captivity. You know, when God doesn't take you out of the furnace, he meets you in the furnace. That's one of the biblical principles that we study throughout the Bible, that we are not promised no furnaces. Jesus said, I did not come to bring peace. I came to bring war between a father and a son, a husband and a wife, a mother and a daughter. I came to bring strife between those people. Because when I offer the kingdom of God, some will go this way and some will go this way, and there it will cause enmity. There are cultures where to join with Christ is to lose everything you have, including your life. Isn't that right, Kingsley? So there's Jesus said, "I didn't come to bring peace." Jesus said, "While you're in the I'm sorry."
During the Reformation.
Yeah.
Exactly what that means. There's Christians killing Christians.
Yeah. Well, they had a lot of it. Jesus said, while you're in the world, you will have tribulation. But be of good cheer, because I've overcome the world. He didn't say you won't have tribulation. So, in the middle of the captivity, God met them. In the middle of the financial downturn, God met them. In the middle of the divorce, God met them. In the middle of the this and that, God met them. They honored the Lord in the midst of their trials, and they were propelled into a place of influence in the court. God returned that honor back upon them, and they prospered. It's kind of like the principle of sowing and reaping. If you honor God, he'll honor you. If you dishonor God, he'll dishonor you. It's just gravitational as a truth. Their influence and authority continued on even into the end of the Babylonian captivity. In Isaiah 3:8-10, the prophet Isaiah is telling the Jews how bad it's going to be when they're getting hauled off into captivity. It's an ugly scene. He's talking about people brought into the streets, men and women stripped and shaved. He's talking about sackcloth thrown over them and having them belted together and walking from Jerusalem to Babylon. And as they die, you just cut them loose and throw them in the ditch and hook up with the next one. He's talking about the death march of Bataan. He's talking about lice. And he's talking about poverty. He's talking to the noble women of Judah who are used to the finest of things about the squalor in which this captivity is going to bring to them. And he stops in the middle of it and he says, for Jerusalem has stumbled and Judah has fallen because their speech and their actions are against the Lord to rebel against his glorious presence. The expression of their faces witnesses against them, and they display their sin like Sodom. They do not even conceal it. Woe to them, for they have brought evil upon themselves. He says, your culture, your nation has embraced Sodom and Gomorrah in terms of your values. You who once were the land of God, the people of God, you have wantonly given yourself to the world, to the devil, to the things of the devil. And he said that for that reason, all of this is going to come upon you. But then he says, but say to the righteous that it will go well with them, for they will eat the fruit of their actions. So what he's saying is those of you who are righteous in the empire, God will be with you in captivity. He will meet you in captivity. It will go well with you in captivity. He's not saying that they won't get marched off. He's not saying they won't be in captivity. He's just saying that those people who are rightly related to God will find a friend in that day. Proverbs 16, it says, and we read this again earlier, when a man's ways are pleasing to the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. And so we see in the story here with Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we see that their ways please God. And so even their captors were at peace with them. That's what the story tells us. This is a historical story. This is not an allegory. This is the story is being written as if it was factual. The claims are that it's factual. One of the things that I like to remember when I get to listening to Discovery Channel and A&E and all these people on the TV who want to tell you, did God really say? You know, was God really there? Could it have been a spaceship? You know, there's when I see all this stuff on television that's designed to eat and erode away our faith in the Scriptures. Or I listen to some of these seminary professors, these professors of theology at some of our great universities, talk about that the Bible is just a big allegory. One of the things I like to remember is that Jesus, John, Paul, James, Matthew, Mark, Luke, Peter, etc., 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 all believed in a literal creation, Noah's flood, and the historicity of Joseph, Daniel, Abraham, etc. So if I've got to listen to all these wise people of the world versus Jesus, John, etc., etc., I'm going with this group. Okay, I could be wrong, but I'm going with this group. I'd rather die with this group than go with this group over here. All right, comments. I've actually quit 2 minutes early. This is somebody write, alert the media. comments. The book of Daniel was not even read until long after Daniel was dead. And it was not originally a book. It was a chronicle of things that went on. And it was put together as a book. It was written at the time, but it was put together as a reading later. If you realize that the first gospel that was written was probably the Gospel of Mark, and it probably didn't go into wide circulation for 30, 40 years. So the things that get written are not immediate. It's not like today where you've got an iPad, you know, and you got Kindle and you know, all this kind of stuff. In the ancient world, when something like this, like even the five books of Moses, you know, those things were written, and the only copy was kept in the Ark of the Covenant. And they would get it out and read it to the people once in a while, you know, and put it back. As far as, you know, people didn't read. So you have this oral translation of history. Now, the stories of Daniel were probably told in the synagogues, you know, even 10, 15 years after they happened, or certainly in his late life, or even after that. But as far as being able to sit down and read all of this, or even know what he had written, it wouldn't have been for decades later. Daniel was really written for later people, not for the people of his day. Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Isaiah, they were written for the people of their day. They actually have a lot of meaning for us, but Daniel was not. I mean, remember, Daniel's writings led the Magi to Bethlehem. I'm not recalling. He does talk about Daniel, but I'm not recalling the verse that you're referring to right now. And you know, we can only speculate. But if you sort of look at them naturally, you know, we have a tendency to look at people like this real with supernatural eyes. You know, like, you know, Jesus went around and he spoke to the cobwebs and they disappeared. Angels did Mary's housework, or, you know, Jesus healed all his friends. You know, Jesus was a natural boy, and so were these people. They were natural kids. They grew up in a natural way. My bet is family. My bet is that they were raised very well by very devout and loving people. Like I said, Daniel was there for the last 14 years of Josiah's reign. He was a member of the royal family. He got to see Josiah and his court operate. My bet is that Daniel and his friends came from good families, that they were inspired by what they saw in Josiah. And they probably sat around like a lot of young people and said, you know, when I get to be, I'm going to walk with the Lord. I'm going to walk with the Lord. And these four apparently meant it. For all the four that we see here, You can almost bet there was 50 who didn't get it this far. And I don't judge them. But you can almost bet that there were 50 who didn't respond to the negativity in this way. Yeah. Well, and you know, I think what happens is you take somebody like Daniel, who's probably 12 or 13 or 14 or whatever it is. I suspect that he didn't have his sled greased for him. In other words, when he fell, he was told to pick it up and go for it. You know, I'm sorry. This wasn't his first rodeo. Going in and getting emasculated and then having all that wasn't the first time he ever faced difficulty. He probably had grown in a culture of praising God in the midst of difficulty. Because after all he's got to do is read David's stuff or anybody who came before that. And David's stuff is why David wrote the 150 Psalms of David were organized as the literature for the temple. By David and by Solomon. And there were five courses a year where each of those psalms were read out in the temple as part of the temple worship, including the one where David said, this is what happened when I committed adultery with Bathsheba. And it's just right up there, David saying that. And five times a year that comes up, David saying that. So when they went to the temple, they would hear all of this, praise the Lord, rejoice in the Lord always, you know. All these kinds of admonitions to praise God in the midst of difficulty, and they would hear the stories about how God delivered them miraculously out of captivity in Egypt and all these other things. They would see that, you know, that there were 12 spies who went into the land, and two of them came back with a faithful story, and the other 10 came back with a science project. You know, two of them came back and said, these men are they're bigger than we are, they're more than we are, but God will give them to us. God has given us this land. The other 10 came back and said, they outnumber us, they're bigger, they're taller, there's giants in the land. We should go somewhere else. When you grow up with that story, and you got to remember that because of that story, the people marched 40 years in the desert because they responded to the 10, not to the 2. So these people grew up on the idea that if you trust God in the face of overwhelming odds, that he will be faithful to you, but if you cave in, then you will reap what you sow. So my bet is that Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were young people who grew up right. They had good families around them. They admired what they saw, and they responded to it with a faithful heart. And when they got a chance to be in that situation, that's what came out of them. Remember, it's online if you feel like I'm teaching heresy and you want to